My guest Bob Balaban is one of the producers and co-stars of the new Robert Altman film, Gosford Park. The filmmakers describe it as part Agatha Christie murder mystery and part Upstairs, Downstairs. It's set in 1932 on a British country estate where friends and family have gathered for a shooting party. The guests have brought their servants. Of course, there's a murder in the house. The family, friends, and servants are all suspects. Bob Balaban is part of the star-studded ensemble cast. He plays an American movie producer who's in England making the film Charlie Chan in London. Balaban has appeared in many films, including Prince of the City, Deconstructing Harry, Waiting for Guffman, Best in Show, Ghost World, and The Majestic. In Seinfeld, he had a recurring role as the network executive who bought Jerry and George's sitcom idea. I asked Bob Balaban about Altman's approach to recording overlapping dialogue. He described a scene in which all the guests are gathered in one room and many conversations are underway.
To shoot scenes and record the dialogue with this many people, Bob does something very radical, which is he has 19 microphones. Every single person out there on that huge set had their own individual body mic and their own individual track on which their dialogue was recorded. So at any point in the proceedings, Bob could listen to 19 different things going on in the group scenes when we were at the table and we were in the dining room and the living room. He could select anybody's dialogue and bring it up and remove anybody else's dialogue who wasn't on their microphone. This is a nightmare. Now, you could be neurotic and indecisive, and you could spend 30 years cutting a movie that's got dialogue like that because you have so many choices. Bob very quickly listens to everything, and he goes, that's funny, that's not funny. Okay, this is good. This is what I want. It's really one of the reasons why Bob must operate in a situation that's not a bureaucracy, you know, that isn't directing by committee with a lot of executives telling him what to do, because he operates so instinctively, and also it would take so long. I mean, the reason that his movies have that Robert stamp to them is he's in complete control of everything, and he needs to be.
Now, as an actor, when you're working in a situation like that, say there's a lot of people in the living room, Everybody's engaged in a conversation, you have your lines, they're being recorded, but you don't know if they're going to actually be used in the movie or not.
Oh, yeah, that's true. I think it's a great thing for a movie. I found that the first scene I shot in the movie was my character was introduced. We all got into the house. There were 23 people in the scene. And I went around going, hello, I'm Morris Wiseman. And then Maggie Smith would go, you know, she wouldn't exactly say hello. And we did the lines we were supposed to say. But then, because I was off in the corner with somebody and the camera was constantly moving, all the scripted lines were spoken during the course of a 3-page scene. And yet, whenever you weren't on camera, you had to maintain a conversation with whoever you were with. Well, that's like rehearsing a play. It's like fabulous background. Oh, this is how my character talks to that person. This is what it feels like to be in the house. This is what my character is noticing right now. You literally get to live and breathe in your costume on the set while you're shooting a great improvisation that is great background for yourself. And after a few days of this, you really do learn a tremendous amount about the world that you're inhabiting. It was a great, great learning experience.
So you're improvising conversations that Altman is recording during the making of the movie. Mm-hmm. Were any of your improvised lines actually used in the film?
Oh, many of them. But many of all of ours. But the movie, I must stress, this is not an improvised movie in any way. I was in Waiting for Guffman and Best in Show, and that is only an improvised movie. That's a basic outline, and then you just say whatever you want. We only did this when we were in large group scenes that needed this to fill in. Otherwise, if you notice other people's movies, usually that have a lot of people in them, everybody's kind of going blah, 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 and they're kind of fake doing whatever it is they're doing, and then they say a real line, and then the camera must get to them at that point. In our case, if the camera lingered on you, there's a wide shot when we're leaving, going for our pheasant hunt, and I was just chatting with Jeremy Northam, and with literally, there are probably 32 characters in this very wide shot, and I come out there, and I started saying to Jeremy, we're going to shoot pheasants, and both me and my character are not exactly woodsmen. And so I said to Jeremy, gee, you know, are pheasants ever dangerous? And then I went on this whole long thing about, yeah, you know, how frightened I was of pheasants, which is true, actually. I with the idea that a pheasant would rush at you and claw your eyes out, I don't know, it could be frightening. Yeah, and he put that in the movie, and it actually gets a rather nice laugh. But I really, at that point, it was such a wide shot, I had no idea what was happening. And working with Robert, and it's not that you always have to be tricked into this, because you really don't. But there is such a feeling of at ease with what you're doing with him, whether it's long shots where they're recording everything and you just get used to it and you stop noticing when you're rolling or not, or small little intimate scenes. He just creates an atmosphere along with this all that lets you know you can be very relaxed, you're very trusting of him, and you know that if it's not working, he just won't put it in the movie because he has consummate taste. He's not just warm and fuzzy. He's got great taste. If something's not working, he doesn't put it in.
Now, you actually come from quite an interesting movie family. Your uncle was the president of Paramount Pictures. Your grandfather headed production at MGM. And your father was one of the co-owners of the Balaban and Katz theaters. These were movie theaters or vaudeville theaters turned into movie theaters?
Well, actually, my father, who I'll talk about in a second, was a little baby when this was all happening. My dad was the youngest of seven brothers in Chicago. And my grandparents had a little grocery store where they all slept like in one room in the back. In 1908, my grandmother walked into a movie theater and said to my uncles, "Kids, this is the movie we're going to go. This is the business." My grandmother went to a movie theater in 1908. She went to a Nickelodeon, and when she went in, she was amazed by the way the thing was run. And she went to her children and she said, "This is the business that we're going to go in. Where else do you pay your money before you see what you're going to get? This is the wave of the future. We have to do this." It's not, and also, it's not like lettuce. The lettuce gets stale and old. You throw it away. The movie gets old. They've seen it. You send it back to them, and they send you a new movie. It was like perfect. So they went heavily into the movie business, hawking everything they had, starting in this tiny little theater, which I think opened in 1908 or 9, the year my father was born. And within 7 or 8 years, they had about 150 movie theaters in the Midwest, pleasure palaces, these giant, beautiful works of art designed in many of them by the firm of Rap and Rap that sort of specialized in this sort of quasi-Egyptian stuff, but very ornate, very beautiful. And it was just an amazing time. The oldest brother, Barney, then left Balaban and Katz, took over Paramount from Adolph Zukor eventually, and then was in partnership with Balaban and Katz, because at that time in history, movie studios owned movie theaters, and it was like a perfect combination to control the Midwest and have, you know, the older brother be at Paramount. It was like an amazing thing. And then, of course, antitrust legislation knocked this out. I'm not sure exactly when that happened, but a lot of my relatives became Republicans at that point, because Democrats were responsible for this. But where they were born in Chicago was this street called Maxwell Street, which was essentially the Lower East Side of Chicago. It was like Orchard Street in New York. And on this one little stretch of pushcarts and cobblestones and very, very poor immigrants, Benny Goodman was on the left, William Paley's family was on the right, Jack Ruby, oddly enough, lived down the block from all of them, and Rickover lived,
the
I think, across the street, Admiral Rickover, Hyman Rickover. So it was this little melting pot that sent roots out that affected everything everywhere. It was must have been something in the water, I think. I'm not sure.
Did you spend time in the projection booth as a kid?
I loved movies, and I was always sitting in theaters. My favorite thing was, in my dad's office, they had to screen movies to see what they would be buying and playing. I don't know if they really had to, but they loved seeing the movies, and I did too. And when I was a kid, every once in a while, they would drag me on a Tuesday night, because that's when they saw the new movies, to the office, where I got to see it was a screening room. I just couldn't believe it. I was 8 or 9 or whatever. And they would show me these things. I remember I went to see my first X-rated movie. I was a kid, and my parents were very liberal about stuff like that. And they said, "Well, don't be shocked, but you're seeing an X-rated movie." It was I Am a Camera. It starred Julie Harris. It's Christopher Isherwood. It's what became Cabaret, you know, basically. And the movie was over, and I was so disappointed. I was a little kid. I told my friends I was seeing an X-rated movie, and my parents approved. I couldn't figure out the dirty part of the movie, because eventually what they did was, many times you'd see them and they'd say, "Yes, we made love last night," or "We're going to make love." And they would say things like that. And of course, in 1954 in Chicago or wherever, you couldn't say you were going to make love to somebody. You could say, "I would kiss you." I thought making love meant kissing somebody and being very nice to them. I had no idea they were actually sleeping together. So that was my first X-rated movie experience. And then I was in an X-rated movie.
Oh, Midnight Cowboy.
I was the X rating.
Describe the scene.
I'm a kid who picks up a hustler on Times Square, John Voight, the Midnight Cowboy, and we have an experience in the balcony of a movie theater, which was very discreet, but you knew exactly what I was doing, and then I threw up in the men's room afterwards, and that was the next little scene in the movie. And when the movie came out, I was the reason for the hard, well, I guess you'd call it a hard R, I don't know, but it was X-rated. You, if you were under 17, you were not allowed to see the movie because of that little moment, which was very modest, I promise. And then after it got the Best Picture Award, mysteriously the rating changed. Now it was an R. Now you could see the movie. I guess it was artistic enough that you could stand what was happening.
Although you're directing and producing now as well as acting, and you started your career as an actor. Did your family hold actors in high regard?
No. They were kind about me because I was their family, you know. And also I was not horrendously successful. I was just working. I mean, the fact that in my generation, a lot of my relatives, you know, didn't do all that much, and they certainly weren't in the movie business necessarily. They had comfortable lives, and they inherited things from their parents, and they didn't. I think the fact that I was out there sort of struggling and actually making a living was very, my father was proud of that fact, because in a way, I didn't exactly have to be, you know, peddling myself the way I was and pushing myself. I didn't exactly have to, although it's sort of debatable.
My guest is actor, producer, and director Bob Balaban. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Bob Balaban. He's one of the producers and co-stars of the new Robert Altman film, Gosford Park. Bob Balaban, I want to read you what Leonard Maltin's Encyclopedia of Film says about you in the Bob Balaban entry.
Oh.
He writes, during the late 70s and 80s, producers looking for physically unprepossessing, soft-spoken intellectual types rarely got past the letter B in their casting directories.
Aww.
No one surpassed Balaban in those roles, and the more dispassionate or loathsome the character, the better he was. Now, from your point of view, how did your unprepossessing intellectual type look affect your casting?
When I was 17 years old and I was in summer stock in Chicago, an actress who was terribly old, she was 38 or something, came up to me and she said, you know, it's very interesting, Bob. You're going to do very well, I think, in New York, and maybe you'll even get into movies. As long as they have parts where you're supposed to look intelligent, you're going to get work. I had no idea what she was talking about, and because, you know, I'm smart enough, you know, but I'm hardly a great genius or intellectual exactly. But I guess I must seem that way because I've always been cast that way. Now, there are times when I wasn't. In Jacob the Liar, a movie that I liked a lot that Robin Williams starred in, and I was the barber. I was actually a barber. I actually talked loud. I was emotional. I did stuff. I can do those things, but, you know, I'm not cast that way that much. Do I mind it? In a way, I might, but in a way, I'm also lucky I get work. You know, I'm happy when I get a job. So I'm glad they know what to make of me in some way.
Now, our engineer for Fresh Air has done a lot of sound work in theater. And he, Bob Purdick, was telling me about a time when he worked in a production that you were starring in, in which you had to grab somebody by their lapels. And you were grabbing so tight that when they pulled away,
I broke my fingers.
You broke your finger. Fingers, more than
well,
one?
Well, two of them, actually.
Really?
He knew that? He remembered that?
Yes, he did.
Oh, my God. That was Speed the Plow, David Mamet on Broadway. I replaced Ron Silver, who won a Tony Award. It was foolish of me to do that, but I had a great time, and I loved to play. And my finger is still sort of bent because I did it 2 years later again, and I broke my finger.
You did it again and you broke your finger?
Mm-hmm. Different play. I grabbed a guy by a Jules Pfeiffer play, grabbed him by the lapels too hard. Don't grab people by the lapels. It's my advice to you.
Yeah, it was the Jules Pfeiffer play that our engineer
Was it? Well,
on,
I had done it in Speed the Plow 2 years before and broken the same finger.
So what went wrong? You were just holding on too tight when they pulled away?
I did the play for a year or 9 months or whatever. And, you know, we had a very well-choreographed fight. It was beautifully done by a very famous person who does all the fights on Broadway. And I'm, you know, 2 feet tall, and I had to grab somebody who was 6'9" or something and shake him by the lapels, throw him to the ground, and then stand over him and scream at him. I mean, it was a fun, exciting moment for me to have, and I thought I eventually pulled it off perfectly well. But you do the same thing like that for months and months and months, you're bound to, at some point, something's bound to happen usually. And it was my finger, thank you. I'm glad it wasn't my head.
Did you continue with the rest of the show?
I did. And then I rushed off to the emergency room, and I had to wait for 10 hours, and I couldn't wait, and I came back and did the next show. And, you know, it was just my finger, but it hurt.
So you had to do the next show before they actually repaired, you know, put it in a cast or whatever?
The show must go on, they say.
How did it heal?
Badly. It's still sore. You know, fingers are kind of tricky. You know, we could have a whole finger show, actually. they put it in a cast, and they fiddled around with it, and they don't do that much. You know, if you ever broke your toe, mostly they just say, wear tight shoes, you know. It hasn't progressed a lot from the Neanderthal days.
One last question. Mm-hmm. Jeremy Northam plays Ivor Novello in Gosford Park, your new movie. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And Ivor Novello was a real singer and performer, songwriter. Mm-hmm. And Jeremy Northam sings some Ivor Novello songs. Whose idea was it to make him a character, to make that real person a character mm-hmm. in the film?
That character came in late in the drafts, and probably only a few months, well, maybe 5 months before we started shooting, because Robert Altman wanted there to be source music. You know, he's sort of famous for that. A lot of his movies have found ways to include real performances of music during the movies. In Kansas City, there was a lot of that. And Bob is very musical. You know, he really is. He's like a jazz musician himself, at least internally. I don't know if he can really play anything. He's very musical. And he wanted there to be this character. He came in one day and he said, it's perfect. Ivor Novello, I love his music. It'll be the centerpiece of the movie. It can be the end credits. I mean, he exactly knew what he was going to do at that point. And the fact that Ivor was not that famous, I mean, he was then, but to you and to me, you probably don't know what he looked like. We got to have a famous, a historical person in the movie, but who was not so famous that you would be worried that Jeremy should look like him or really sound like him. Then it turned out that Jeremy Northam has a beautiful singing voice and did just a fantastic job, and he played the piano even. We didn't even know that, you know, when we cast him. It was just lucky.
Well, Bob Balaban, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. Nice to be here, Terry. I love your show. I think it's fantastic.
Bob Balaban is one of the producers and stars of the new Robert Altman film, Gosford Park.